Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
The Lord came to Noah one afternoon. There will be a flood and it will happen real soon. Build thee an ark, big enough for all. Yourself, your family, one pair each of animals. Given by the Lord, go unto the ark where you'll be safe. As soon as they got in there, it began to rain. The appointed day had come, and they were all shut in. The people that had left now were knocking to get in. But it was now too late. The Lord had sealed the door. Any chance they might have had now was gone forevermore.
As soon as they gone in there, it began to rain.
Two by two,
four by four,
obeying instructions
given by the Lord.
Go into the ark
where you'll be safe.
As soon as they had gone in there, it began to rain.
As soon as they had gone in there, it began to rain.
Everlasting proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy is that He creates people like Tammy Swindell and her delightful child, Robert. That is two by two. Inexplicably enough, that was requested. So there you go. Somebody's like, I'm so glad you're back. Play two by two. It was as though he was waiting like 7.5 months or whatever it's been just so he could hear that song. He had no access to it in his private life. Wait for the Rick Emerson Show to return. We are happy to fulfill your requests. It is 15 minutes after the hour of 1 o'clock in this, the month of June, in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming by and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high above the milk packing district right here in beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us today. Draw near that ye might be amused and entertained in myriad ways. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor. Hold on, let me do the great on-turning of the phone. And there we go. Somebody asked yesterday, by the way, if we have a Skype name in addition to just having a number. Because I think the difference is, I think if you call, if it's like a Skype to Skype thing, like if you're like if you call on a phone line, you know, then that's all swell and dandy. And it works, as we found out. I mean, we've taken a passel of calls since we came back on the air. That works. If you do like a thing from one computer to another, I think it's like of slightly higher quality or it's ISDN quality or something. So the answer is, yeah, the Skype name there is it's just Rick Emerson Show. Rick Emerson Show. Our phone number, though, is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Your comments, questions, clarifications, kvetches, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, limericks, haiku, whatever you might have on this Thursday. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It is rick@rickemerson.com. Or you can do the live chat at rickemerson.com. I can spin just this number of communicative plates. You know, I've got the phone number and the Skype and the email and the text box. But that's it, man. It doesn't add anything else.
You're not ready to start tweeting live you're on the radio?
Well, no. You know, do it. I'm not going to read it. I mean, send away. Won't be read. Not even going to see it. You know what? And it's not because I don't care. It's just that at a certain point, my brain would become like our encoding machine was the first day or so that we were doing this, where it was like, I'm just trying to do too many things. I'm slowing. You know, but unfortunately, you can't just jack open the back of my head and stick a gigabyte of RAM into my brain. Would that you could, because I would have done it a long time ago. So.
You did jump on Facebook yesterday, though, and post the picture of your dog.
That's right. Well, but I mean, come on. If you wouldn't do it for your dog, for whom would you do it, Don? Don Taylor is here working on some news stories for your edification and amusement. What manner of story will you have for the good people of Portland to be on today, Don Taylor?
Well, we will discuss a bookshop in Salem that has changed its name to avoid confusion with a popular political movement.
I know exactly the place you're talking about because I drove by it about a month ago on the way to the coast where I had some fantastic caramel corn. Boy, that was really a thing where, like, the direct object of that sentence didn't end up being what I thought it was going to be. That's how my brain works, by the way. You can tell that even halfway through it, I was distracted by a bright, shiny object inside my own brain.
I saw this bookstore. It was near the caramel corn place, which is the real object of my affection.
I'm not going to give it away. We'll make this a guarantee. I know exactly the place you're talking about because Laura and I drove by it, and I'm like, that's weird. I wonder if that bookstore is associated with... No, they couldn't be. Well, that's unfortunate. And I actually said, sucks for them.
All right. What else do we have?
We have a Lake Oswego family that is suing their uphill neighbor after a 2009 landslide. A fellow in New York who built a nuclear reaction in a warehouse. We also have a massive Michael Jackson watch.
Fantastic.
And a religious nutcase watch.
Excellent. Religious nutcase on the watch, watch on the way today. By the way, I have located now all of my watches, with the exception of, there's a couple that I haven't looked for, but we haven't really needed. There's this whole sort of disaster that happened. No, I'll get to it in just a second. Anyway, so religious nutcase watch on the way today. Jackson watch. It is Thursday. Let's have no illusions. I don't think it's like a rerun or something. But we are in fact going to be doing our True Blood recap today, and that's nobody's fault but mine, as Robert Plant once said. I know the show aired on Sunday. And I know that everybody else watched it like Sunday, maybe Monday, possibly Tuesday. Speaking for myself, saying for me now, I watched it last night because I just, there's a bunch of crap I was busy dealing with. What with launching two back-to-back the radio shows, which, you know, now that we're doing it, that's a lot of work. It's a fair piece of work, as they say. So
it really is. Now that we're actually in the middle of it and doing it, I'm thinking, what were we thinking?
I have no idea. It's escaping me now what the actual logic was.
This nerd thing was just crazy. Crazy, I tell you.
An ongoing nightmare, Don Taylor. So last night I finally got a chance to watch True Blood, and even knowing what it was going to be, even having, because you gave me a little bit of an overview, you said, just so you know, when you watch True Blood, and this is how you put it, you said, I have two words for you, Nazi werewolves. And I said, well, that's okay. I don't know how at the time.
Actually, you accused me of making it up.
I did. Well, I accused you of making it up, and when you insisted that it was true, I think in my head somehow I thought, well, okay, but how interesting can that be? Which, I mean, when you say it out loud, just makes me sound like a retard. I mean, they're Nazi werewolves. They're awesome. And one of them, Nazi werewolves, and I think one of them was hot, too. I think one of them was a hot, topless blonde chick. So, I mean, there was that. But anyway, so we'll get to True Blood later on today. We have another installment of Pop Culture Authority. Today's Pop Culture Authority asks this question. How did Captain Crunch, or Captain Crunch breakfast cereal, as Don Taylor calls it, being linguistically accurate, contribute to the rise of Apple computers? That is all on the way. And last hour, during Legion of News, which is the news show we do from noon to 1 over at pdx.fm, somebody, and I think his name is Rick Emerson, asked the question, what would happen if you tased a watermelon? And I'm not talking about with a stun gun. I'm talking about the actual full-on
Because the thing about the stun gun is, well, I mean, I guess maybe they're the same. I don't know if they're different in terms of voltage.
I believe they are, yes. Because there's like tens of thousands of volts in an actual taser. It will make you like fall to the ground and black out. I'm not sure. I think the little handheld ones aren't nearly as powerful.
See, I don't know that that's true. I think you might be either making that up or that's a thing that maybe was once true. Because if that was the case, and we're leaping into this head first right at the beginning of the show, so that's fine. If that were the case, why would they have to have tased that kid like five times in the Sweet Home or Salem or St. Helens or some goddamn place?
I don't know, because I've been to actual live demonstrations where the police
You've
were...
You've been to a tasing?
Yeah.
Are you going to this evening's tasing? No, I have a cotillion. I'm sorry.
One of the great things about being in community journalism, as I was for many years, is you
and
get the
still
opportunity...
are, Dawn.
Yes, and you get the opportunity to go places and see stuff like cops going, look, can we have a volunteer, someone who doesn't have a heart condition? We're going to use the stun gun on you, and we're going to use the taser, and then you can see what happens.
Wow.
You know, and they use it, and the person just drops like a rock. That's just it. Just boom.
Do they...
Ow. I just hurt myself.
As you were trying to illustrate the dropped like a rock phrase, you just whacked your hand right into the top of this table, which I think is made out of granite and pain. Have you ever seen anybody be pepper sprayed?
Not live.
I have, man.
Not in front of me.
Years ago, I was in front of a bar somewhere. I think it was in Salt Lake. And there was a guy who was causing a bit of a ruckus. He was a bit of a ne'er-do-well, and he wouldn't clear out. And the cops said, you there, am-scrayed. He wouldn't. Instead, am-scraying did not happen. And so the cops just eventually they said, well, okay, we're going to give you a three, a two. And it was... the only person I know, you know, in my real life, who has been pepper sprayed, is my friend Lyle, who was going to the police academy. And as part of that, they said, "Look, if you're going to be pepper spraying a suspect, you know, you got to be able to know what it does. We want you to know the effect that pepper spray has." And so they lined all these guys up, and if I remember the story correctly, he said the worst part was just sort of it was waiting there for the spraying to happen, because they lined all the recruits up. And they just went down the row one by one. You know, what's your name? Jenkins. Ksh. What's your name? Smith. Ksh. And they went to my friend Lyle. You know, and they sprayed him. And he said it was just pain beyond anything he had ever even imagined, just being pepper sprayed. And that's not having 50,000 volts put into your body or something.
I think my husband had that done to him when he was in the Army, because he was in the military police, and they went through anti-interrogation training and things like that. And I think he may have... had to be pepper sprayed.
He would fold almost immediately. There's no secret there. I mean, it's just my read on him, and maybe I'm wrong about that.
What I have right here, by the way, it says according to this, and you know, it's the internet, so we'll see. I was wrong. It's backwards. A stun gun. Well, a taser. All taser models are 50,000 volts, and they cost anywhere from $300 to $1,000. And replacement cartridges are $30 per shot. Stun guns. Run anywhere from 150,000 volts to 2 million volts.
How can something be 2 million volts?
I don't know.
I act like it's not even possible, like it can't exist. That's beyond the realm of possibility in
science.
As
a rule of thumb, this says 500,000 volts will take about 3 seconds to drop your assailant, and the 2 million volts will drop them in less than a second. And all taser models are 50,000 volts, so... apparently, a taser is really just to...
Is it a sustained voltage? Is that the difference? Because you just... Don just did a facial expression, which is universally understood to mean, what am I, the encyclopedia? You know, that I gave you the information. What else do you want?
Apparently, it's also, I like it says here, 99% of the time you can avoid a problem by simply firing your stun gun into the air. The loud crackling sound of the 2 million volt shock and awe stun gun can be heard over 100 yards away.
Is the shock and awe stun gun a specific kind of stun gun?
I believe it is, yes. It's the shock and awe bodyguard stun gun, and that's the one that does 2 million volts.
All right. It seems like, I mean, I don't know how many volts your body is putting off at any moment, because they always say your body is an electrical system. So I don't know how many volts your heart or your whatever that is that's putting off electricity in your body puts off. It seems like 500,000 volts ought to work a lot faster than that. It seems like that ought to actually just reduce you to ashes immediately. Yeah. They just hit you with that, and suddenly it's like you've just opened the Ark of the Covenant. But I don't know how any of that works. But last hour, we somehow had the discussion of tasing a watermelon. And it was Dawn's theory, if I've got this right, that if you tased a watermelon, it would, quote, explode.
Well, now I'm not so sure, because apparently an actual taser is a wimpy little weapon.
Well, but I mean, if a stun gun, maybe, like if we had, which Sarah Dillon has a stun gun, And I think maybe you are just leaping to the explosion because, for instance, in depictions from Hollywood, that is how everything ends. I mean, shooting anything, throwing anything, anything falling off and tumbling into a ravine, it all ends with a... You know, so maybe you are just conditioned to assume, like, because even things that aren't explosive, even things that have no, they have no flammable materials nor accelerants, it's like if Mel Gibson just looks at them, suddenly it's just, you know, they're into the air.
I'm thinking, you know, a watermelon is a contained device that is full of water.
Are you thinking the water somehow expands too quickly and that the hull of the watermelon?
It would heat.
Cannot contain it?
The electricity would superheat it.
Oh, I see. So you're thinking. Are you thinking that the inside of the watermelon would then
it would steam,
and then it would not be able to gradually seep out
right.
of the so rind of the melon, and then it would explode.
Right.
Not unlike microwaving an egg.
Yes, exactly.
All right, we'll have to figure that out at some point. All right. Well, in any event, it's 503-505-6964. So later on today, we'll probably try to figure out something about this this tasing a watermelon.
And I'm getting all of this stuff from Thomas Gill and the thing about milliamps and what you would need to boil the liquid. It's like he's geeking out on me in the text box, and I'm sorry, Thomas Gill, I'm putting you aside.
By the way, here's the thing about so Thomas Gill is the chief engineer of this program and really a frighteningly intelligent individual. I don't mean frightening like you sense that he's building a rape camp at home or something. I mean
that we know of.
See, now here's the thing, because you said that you're going to be the first person in it. That's the thing. And I have avoided said incarceration. No, just because you realize he probably could build some sort of device that did nuclear acceleration. Like he could, you know, if he came in here, he could probably do tabletop fusion, like if we actually demanded that he do it. I think I mentioned this story to Don last week. I think we were here and I was talking about so Thomas was here in town. He was helping us set up the studio. He was gracious enough to come in and help us sort of sort through the myriad technical problems that we faced when trying to put the studio together and to get these two back-to-back shows on the air, which you know, I didn't have any experience with, and really none of us did. Thomas had some experience with it, so he came to town, and then in conjunction with our friend Seamus in Colorado, they kind of made all this, you know, work. But so I would go, and you know, he took the train here, so he didn't have a car. So I would go pick him up at the hotel, and we'd come here and we'd work in the studio and whatever. So we had all these long conversations in the car because I would inevitably, day after day, I would turn on to MLK, which is just that is a road to nowhere. That is just a road to high blood pressure and hate and sweat, turning on to MLK at any point. We have reached some sort of event horizon in Portland traffic where you can no longer go more than 50 yards out of your driveway in any direction before you end up where there's a guy holding up a sign that says closed to through traffic, local traffic only.
That's summer in Portland.
And if I can just do a deviation inside a deviation, I don't know what that sign means when it says through traffic, no, local traffic only. What does that mean exactly?
The road is
not blocked.
No.
It's not a dead end.
No, those signs are operating on the honor system. They're basically saying if you live on the street or you're going to a business on the street, you know, feel free to enter. But if you're just driving through to get to like the other side, if you were planning to just use the street as a throughway, go around. And the thing is, people honor it. But you know, it's the honor system. It's like, stop me.
Well,
I dare you to stop me.
I should say that I do not honor that. And maybe I don't mean that. And I'm not trying to be a jackass and make anybody's job more difficult. But I have places to be. I have a life to lead. So I'm just telling you this right now. This is just sort of this is from me to you. This is from me to Multnomah County. If you don't want me to go down a road, close it. That's the thing. Put up a sign. Even if it's a fake. You know what they ought to do? They should just put up a fake sign that says dead end. I mean, that's right there, because presumably, because think about it this way, if you're, and I will get back to the point of the Thomas Gill and the Thomas, and the you know, the tasing and the watermelon and the Mohegan, but if you are going onto that street because there's a business there that you, you know, you got to go transact some sort of, you know, you have interaction with them, or if you have a house on that street, presumably it wouldn't matter to you if it said dead end. But if you're going to be using it as a through street, mm-hmm. then the dead end would probably stop you because you think, oh, I used to be able to cut through. I guess not. I guess I'll have to go to division. So if you want to stop people from going through that for the same cost, in fact, probably for less cost because the dead end sign is very small, because the signs that say through traffic, no, local traffic only, you know, this is a huge rectangle. You get yourself a sign for a third the cost is dead end, you solve the problem. There you go. Rick Emerson has saved you tax dollars.
My question has always been, what are my legal obligations to do what I am told by people who are flagging for a private company. I mean, if there's like somebody is backing a truck out and there's a guy in the street and he's waving, you stop out of courtesy.
Yes.
But when there's some kind of private construction or something going on and they have guys there that are obviously hired just to direct traffic, am I required to actually do what they say? Because honestly, there have been times when I've just felt like, no, I don't have to do what you tell me
I'm
to do.
I'm going to disregard your instructions.
Who are you?
Private companies, are you talking about, you're not talking about like regular like city construction though?
Right. There's city construction and then they have actual flaggers. And I believe you can be ticketed for disregarding those people. I'm just saying that if you're driving by a construction site, if somebody is putting on some kind of an event and they've just put up some cones, and they've got a guy standing there waving traffic through and then holding up two hands going, stop, stop, hold on. Now you guys get to go. Do I have to actually do what they say? Because they're not anyone.
I don't believe so. I think that is a big, and it also because it's not, well, it depends on whether it's private property or not. I mean, if it's not private property, I would imagine that you are only required to follow whatever laws it is that the city or the county has passed. Mm-hmm. But then again, but see, here's the... I have to get back on track after this. But my understanding of it would be that they probably could find a reason to ticket you because they screw you with this sort of elastic clause that they put into motor vehicle regulations and traffic laws. It's that basic speed rule type thing. Because you remember traffic safety, but the basic speed rule is that you may not operate a motor vehicle on any public road at a speed which exceeds that which is necessary for safe driving. Which is like, if the speed limit is 55, but the road is covered in the locusts and thumbtacks, then it's like you can only go like as safe as, you know, you can only go up to the speed limit where that's going to be dangerous. So they would probably nail you on some sort of contributing to a public hazard thing if they really wanted to. I think what it comes down to is the man can probably ticket you at any time for anything if he really wants a reason. That is one of the many, many rationales that I have for being polite to cops, even when they do not deserve it, which sometimes you will be pulled over by a law enforcement official who does seem a little persnickety, as though he's spoiling for a bit of a fight. Doesn't matter. I am the most polite, courteous guy you will ever meet if the cop will. You know why? Because a cop, and I don't say this with any disrespect, a cop is a citizen who's allowed to shoot you if he feels like you really got it coming. Like, if he feels like the circumstances warrant it, just give you a good shooting right there. So that's a guy to whom I speak with politeness.
For me, it's a combination of growing up in the Los Angeles area and having a father who was a fireman. So my formative years, I saw my father in uniform a lot. Which is, you know, very Freudian. So
I'm glad you said that because I was going to ask a question about that, but you answered.
So between that and actually growing up in Southern California and having just a natural fear of police, like all citizenry there do, cops scare the hell out of me. I view them with resentment and bitterness, but whenever I have to deal with one, it's like, yes, sir. Anything you need, sir. My, your shoes are shiny.
You know that Ken Osmond, who played Eddie Haskell, was on the LAPD. For like 29 years or something, he was, as they say, on the job down there. I love the idea that if you were in Los Angeles at a certain point, you might have been pulled over by Eddie Haskell, which I imagine would be equal parts amusing and terrifying. Anyway, let's just stop for a moment. Backing up. I would be on these long car rides with Thomas Gill from his hotel to this studio.
Well, that's right. There was an anecdote going on.
Normally, I'm the guy who doesn't remember, but today I actually held onto the tether of that thought as it was going by.
I'm proud of you.
So Thomas Gill spent about a week here in Portland working on the studio, getting us up to speed before our launch on Monday the 21st. And so we would be driving along, and, you know, and as was our wont, we would always just fall into some sort of geekish talk about whatever. Like I had this whole thing about the lightsaber that I was wondering about, which he actually knew the answer to, unsurprisingly enough. But he just has this freakish ability with numbers, freakish from my perspective anyway. And I know that I'm going to get this wrong, so this is just for demonstrative purposes only. This is not like a functional... I was talking about the metric system and how, you know, even as just like a math idiot, it seems obvious to me that we ought to switch over to the metric system. And it's just like a stupid American thing that we don't. I understand there's a certain amount of pleasure to be had by telling the rest of the world, hey, suck it. You know, we're going to continue to, you know, we're going to measure everything in hectares or whatever, you know, or fathoms or something. I think it came about because I was talking about the Legion of News show. And I said, you know, that my wife hated the name Legion of News. And I said, no, it's like Legion of Doom. And she didn't get that. She didn't get that it was a superhero reference. And so lacking the knowledge that there was a Legion of Doom with Lex Luthor. She did not know what Legion of News was, and she said she thought that it was like the biblical amount of the Legion. And Thomas Kiel, without even missing a beat, he just said, well, a Legion is 10,000. And I said, what? Because I was sort of going on and on about how nobody knew what it was. It was like this mythical event. He goes, no, it's 10,000. I said, what do you mean it's 10,000? And then he kind of blinked, and he said, it's 10,000. And I said, well, okay. So then I was talking about the metric system and how the metric system, you know, is great, but that, you know, but that you have to convert things. And that, like, let me just tell you this. Goddamn, I was trying to fix something, foolishly enough, on my car a while back, and which is just like, that's an exercise in insanity. I mean, the only reason for me to try to fix something on my car is because I haven't had an embolism yet that day, and I just want to find the fastest way to, you know, to be face down in the driveway in my own sputum. So I'm looking at something in the car, and I can't quite figure out how to get. It's like a panel that I think is hiding like a fuse or something I need to access. And I go online, and I look up. I get a Ford, and I look up my car, and it says, say it along with me, kids. You want to get your 5/16 wrench. I don't know what the F, the 5/16. Just tell me how big it is. Just tell me how many millimeters or whatever the thing is. 5/16. So I'm going on about this to Thomas Gill, and he says, I will get this wrong. But he says, well, you know, the metric system is actually really easy. All you have to do is just multiply everything by 0.65. And then we kind of drive along in silence, and I process, and I thought about saying, well, you know, that's all well and good. But A, I won't remember that, because I'm probably even now remembering it incorrectly, and that I won't be able to do that. And so, and then he said, without being prompted, he said, this is why we hired the guy to the studio. He said, you know, and Celsius to Fahrenheit is even easier, because the deal with that is you just multiply everything by 9/5 and add 30. And then it wide cuts to us just driving along in the car again, and me blinking, thinking, okay, you know, I can barely tie my shoes someday. And the final little fillip on the story is, in my experience, if you meet a guy that has just an unbelievable, uncanny ability with numbers, without exception, to a man, that guy, and it is usually but not always a guy, if you meet a guy that just can do numbers inside and out, that he's one of those, like, I have memorized pi to the 75th decimal place. He's one of those, like, Toscanini guys. If you meet a guy like that, he will always, always, when you comment on his facility with math, he will say something to the effect of, oh, well, no. I mean, I'm really nothing. If you want to see somebody who's good with numbers, you ought to meet. And then he will insert the name of some other guy he knows. Thomas Gill, in this instance, referred to his father. And he said that he goes, well, you know, my father, he really knows numbers. He makes me look like a piker. And then I couldn't help myself. I said, for instance? And he said, well, my father can take the tire pressure in just one of the tires on your automobile and tell you exactly at what speed your car will hydroplane. And then we just, again, we're driving along in silence in the car, because how am I going to respond to that? What possible skill or ability do I have? I can name...
How does that even come up, by the way? I was wondering.
I don't know. And is it... Okay, I mean, let me just ask you this, Dawn. I'm not trying to make you feel inferior.
Oh, it's too late.
But, well, excellent. Then I need to not have any fear about plunging on ahead. Is there any non-pornographic skill you have that is equivalent to that? To his dad being able to take your tire pressure and tell you at what speed your car will hydroplane?
Oh, God, no.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing I can do. Look, I know that I got to, you know, I can tell you a lot about, like, you know, KISS or Star Blazers or something. But that's stupid. I mean, yeah. I mean, this literally right here. This is the only place that knowledge is useful, and it's only occasionally useful here because they fire me like every 2 years. So,
yeah, my mutant talents are things like, you know, I can put on lip gloss without looking in a mirror, and I can read things upside down.
Yeah,
that's about it. I don't have anything that's really useful or impressive.
This is you know what I can do. I can look at a sentence, and I can tell you what the middle letter is in the sentence.
Really?
I used to be able to. I don't know that I can anymore. Yeah. You know, it can't be like absurdly long. But I mean, if you show me like a 10-word sentence, I can just look and I can immediately tell you what the middle letter is. And I don't know why. My brain just either always had that or it just developed that ability at some point. Yeah, I am not as good at anything as, you know, it just in that one small isolated instance the dad is with. Like, even if it was just that ability. I can take your tire pressure and tell you at exactly what mile per hour your car will hydroplane. If it was that divorced from all other math knowledge, it would still be impressive. But the thing is, you know it's not. You know that is microcosmic. You know that is a representation of the fact that he's a genius and I am functionally retarded, really. I mean, that's kind of where it all falls down. So, anyway, the hell are we talking about? Oh, because he's telling you about wattage and volts and amps and whatever.
Well, yeah. Now the whole time you've known him, he's just been showing off.
I know.
Square root of the tire pressure times 9, and 1 kilometer is 0.62.
Thanks so
much.
The thing is, the space inside my head for that knowledge is not even the size of a thimble. I mean, it's like a flea's navel that I got set aside for math knowledge. So you're going to tell me that, and you know what's going to – it's going to go – my brain is sort of like a VIC-20 in that it's got, like at best, like an external tape drive. There's no hard drive, no flash drive. And you know what? As soon as you turn off the computer, the massive 16K memory, gone.
Maya, I pride myself in the fact that I'm not typically female in a lot of ways, but I have this – ridiculously lopsided brain where I'm absolutely excellent when it comes, you know, to writing and reading and things that are both had to do with spatial relations and words. But I'm functionally retarded when it comes to math. When I went to college and I took my college entrance exams, the guy actually did a double take when he looked at them to make sure that they belonged to the
same
person.
There's a missing number here. Hold on.
Well, he just got the results and I was in the upper top percentile in the math and stuff, and I was in the, you know, needs to go to the remedial, like, retard classes for the math. Because and that was the point when I actually college, when I found out that there is such, I can't remember what it's called now, but there is such a thing as, like, math dyslexia. And I have it. I'm horrible at math. I transpose numbers. I don't understand. It is completely abstract to me. I can only do it if it's related to something very specific, like, I've been a chef, so I can do fractions that are involved with cooking, because that's physically something. I know that it's a physical thing, but if it's just numbers on a page and I have to do, like, you know, calculations, it makes no sense to me at all.
Somewhere there's a Lifetime movie in this that's begging to be made, where, like, you teach a group of hardscrabble youths in a school somewhere, but who love to cook, and you teach them all about math by using, by making a flan or something.
And we learn a valuable lesson about friendship.
Exactly. I'm trying to think if there was, in fact, an episode of The Wire. And one of the great things about The Wire, which, you know, as everybody will tell you, as I will tell you right now, as everybody on Earth will tell you relentlessly ad nauseum long after you've asked them to quit telling you, The Wire, which is the greatest TV show in the history of the world, they actually did manage to pull off one of the biggest cliches in all of filmed entertainment. They managed to actually replicate this and to make it not hokey, but it was a sequence where a teacher is, in fact, quizzing a kid about math. And the kid doesn't understand the math problem, and so he is then – one of the other students in the class takes over and puts the math problem in terms of crack selling. And the kid immediately has it and ends with, like, and he got to go beat his ass. And it was awesome. So I don't even really have that ability. You took SATs?
No, I didn't take SATs. I took college entrance.
Is that not the same thing?
No, because I took...
I didn't take anything, so I got nothing.
I got out of school early because I was failing everything except for art and drama, and so I took the GED.
Everything except for art and drama, which it's impossible to fail. There is no...
I don't think it's impossible to fail if you just didn't go, like, which is why I was failing all my other classes, because I would go to school and just go to art
you
and drama.
You could probably be aborted
and
still pass drama class.
Other classes.
And you just sit in the art supplies closet and huff paint thinner all day or something?
But anyway, I took the GED, and then that was great because I knew that I had essentially already graduated on paper.
Right.
And so I just kept going to school and going to art and drama and not going to anything else. But then I went to Santa Monica Community College because at that point I was thinking, oh, I'll actually get my AA and then go to a four-year college because I don't know why I was thinking that.
Show them they were wrong to fail me.
Because that never happened. But yes, Santa Monica City College is actually a very good school for a community college. It's a very good school. The community college in my neighborhood, in my town, is called El Camino College, and it was commonly referred to as the high school with ashtrays. And I did not want to go there. And you did not have to take entrance exams to El Camino, by the way, because they didn't assume you were going to a four-year college were going there.
What does an entrance exam consist of? Is it like an SAT, though? I mean, is it just like math and verbal?
Proficiency tests to see what level of class you should
Where you'd be placed, like what you could
take. Yes.
I have equal parts been happy about and regretted that I never took any, because I knew like way before. Here's the thing. I knew, and God bless her, my sainted mother knew that just there were, you know, I was born to walk a different path. What is it that the mom says in Cool Hand Luke? She just says, well, sometimes a mother gets a feeling about a child. And I just ain't never had that for you. She had it for Luke, but not for the other kid. Anyway, but my mom knew. The writing was like on the wall in letters 15 feet high, like, will not be making anything of his life. So I didn't bother to take the ACT or the MAT or the SAT or any of that stuff. I've always kind of wanted to take the SAT, but it's for purely selfish reasons. You know why? And this is the same reason I will never take the SAT. And then we'll go to the news desk here in a second, because I see that we're already like way into the show. And by my own clock, which I actually made up to keep me on track during this. See, without anybody to fire us, it's like I just feel like, well, you know, I will make my own path. I will blaze away through the afternoon with no structure. And then I realized that was not going to work. So we created, you know, basically the same structure for the show we've always had, but just as we always do, we tend to disregard it sometimes. So we'll go to the news desk here in just a second. We've got a Jackson Watch coming up today, Religious Nutcase Watch, a True Blood recap, and today's edition of Pop Culture Authority, which answers this question: how did Captain Crunch breakfast cereal contribute to the rise of Apple computers? Plus, we'll talk about tasing a watermelon and what might happen. Because, see, the thing is, I could buy a watermelon. Sarah's got a stun gun. Parking lot outside. Microphones right here. Ka-ching! What was I saying? But I've always wanted to take the SAT, but for purely selfish reasons. Because I want to be... Pardon me. I want to take the SAT because in my fantasy, what happens is I sit down, I take the SAT, I probably blow the math thing altogether. I mean, I wouldn't even get my name right there. But that I would score like a perfect whatever. What's perfect? Like 800 or something?
I have no idea.
But I think it's like an 800 and 816. So I think it's an 800. I would get like a perfect 800 on the English. So then I'd be able to say like, and I got my education on the street, not in one of your fancy schools. Because like you have that fantasy of like you're suddenly like you're Matt Damon in Good Will Hunting, you know, where you're like, I didn't have none of your fancy book learning, yet I am smarter than all of ye. But that wouldn't happen.
Well, and particularly the longer you're out of school, the more time you've had to forget a lot of the things that are going to be on those tests.
Well, it's like the same reason that as much as we have always talked about, have you ever had an IQ test?
Yes.
What's your IQ?
I had two IQ tests. The first one, when I was in elementary school, it was...
Wait, hold on. Don't tell me. Let me guess. Okay, does it change?
Well, your answers on the tests are going to change depending on when you take it.
Is it the same test? In other words,
no. I think there are a number of IQ tests.
Do they give you one designed for one age and then later you got a different test designed for a separate age?
I did take two different tests and they did have different things.
Were they
them.
Approximately
I think
the
when,
same?
When you're
score?
In like when you're in like the fifth grade and they give you a test, they're not going to ask you too many like deeply smart things. They're mostly cognitive. How good are you at figuring stuff out?
Was your revealed IQ, was it roughly the same in both tests?
There was actually an 11-point jump between the elementary school one and the high school one.
La-di-da. All right, let me...
Well, I don't know what that actually means. I'm just... that's the best I could do with math.
Means you were 11 points smarter.
Yeah.
All right, so Don's IQ... I'm gonna have to think on it. I have to guess it later on. Well, because here's the thing, because I don't even really know how the IQ thing works, because I think that what I was always told the IQ break it, because you always hear the thing, well, above 140 is genius, above 100 is average. You know, if it's below 70, you drool a lot, and you know, and you have scabbed up knees. But then somebody told me that that's wrong. Somebody told me that the scale I was using it on, Somebody told me that I was basically using like the thing at the circus where if you hit it hard enough, it says He-Man or whatever, and that it was not close to being accurate. So I'm going to have to think on.
And I just realized there was actually only an 8-point difference between the two because I was
apparently not in the arithmetic department
again,
either.
Again, the math skills not so good.
My whole thing is if I took the SAT test now as a grown man. I would in my fantasy scenario, I get a perfect score, and then I angrily throw down the number 2 pencil, and I say I'm out, and then I stomp out of the classroom, and then like a Tupac song plays on the soundtrack.
But for me, I always think it would be like watching Jeopardy, that I'd go in all full of thinking I'm going to do really good, and I'd sail through some of it, and then geography, and then I would just be screwed.
And my thing is I don't even think that I would be screwed. This really is, I guess, a window into any number of my personality facets. I don't even think that I would be screwed. The reason I don't take the SAT is I am afraid that I would just be average. I am afraid that I would just be the middle of the bell curve. That's my thing. I could handle
it. Just come back stamped, not special.
Yeah. I mean, I could handle failing, like bombing it all together. Because if I just absolutely choked on the test like that and just did terribly, then at least I could say, well, what can you do? I led a hard Scrabble existence. Or if I aced it, I could be like, in your face, educational system. But if it comes back, I'm like, you are typical. Next, I'd be like, okay. Then you just got to go home and deal with yourself in some violent fashion. That's not going to happen. All right, it is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. And by the way, speaking of the phone, two things. One, we got an email from a guy who's listening in Japan, and he asked how it is that he can call in if he is listening in Japan. Let's see, where did it go? I have it right here. It says, wait for it. Here we go. Rick, I am currently living in Japan. If I wanted to call into the show, is there a non-phone number way to contact you via Skype? Best show ever. Raven. R-E-V-A-N. Ravan.
Revan?
Revan. Whatever. So you can call at 503-505-6964, or you can direct contact us via Skype. It is Rick Emerson Show. You can also chat online at rickemerson.com. Coming up, Religious Nutcase Watch, Jackson Watch, Pop Culture Authority, and a recap of Sunday's True Blood. That is all in the way right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. At the news desk, however, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
The Tea Party Bookshop in Salem has a generous selection of titles on spirituality and personal growth. There's a poetry reading on the third Thursday of every month and a pagan meetup scheduled for July 16th when people are invited to enjoy a nice evening chatting with fellow pagans. People who are angry about the new healthcare law and happy about Sarah Palin wouldn't necessarily shop for books there. Which is one reason why owner Joanne Kohler has decided that they are going to change the name. There was some confusion, Kohler says. Some people wanted us to be a Tea Party bookstore and were disappointed when they came in and we didn't carry those kinds of books. Others maybe didn't come in because they thought we were affiliated with the Tea Party. So she said she had some interesting discussions, but never had any problems with anyone who came in expecting something else. People would come in and smell incense or see a prayer flag and realize it wasn't what they were looking for.
So when Laura and I went to the coast about, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, this is the trip where I had the fantastic caramel corn, and I've actually forgotten the name of the caramel corn company. I'd never had it before. And then so we were talking about it, and I said, "Do you remember the name of that fantastic caramel?" It was unreal. It was otherworldly how good it was. But we have forgotten the name of the company that made it, and then we realized we are going to deliberately avoid seeking out the name because then I would have to buy more of it, and then I would just. And so it'd be massive. So
remind me to make you some caramel corn sometime because I make awesome caramel.
See, here's the thing. I got kind of a weakness for that, especially if I mix it with cheese corn. It was unbelievably good. It was some caramel corn company based in Eugene. And we really had to be – here's what trash I am, by the way. Here's what a massive hick I am. Like, you didn't know that. So we're at the coast, and she knows a guy. We know a guy who knows a guy, but we know a guy who has a place at the coast. He and his boyfriend have a place, but you know, they're only there every now and again, and so occasionally they'll kind of let, you know, friends use it or whatever. And it actually is sort of a double, it's like a cabin with like a guest cabin sort of attached. So there's one that's sort of always ready for company. And he's like, yeah, you know, go use it for the weekend, or just go to the coast, and, you know, of course, it's like great and tasteful, and, you know, and it, you know, it's every tiny bit of decor is perfect, and, you know, and it's got like this glorious view of the ocean, and like every the sheets are like 9 million thread count or whatever. But it because they're not there very often, they don't stock it with any food. There's no, I mean, all the cupboards in the fridge are empty and whatever. So we go to the store, and, you know, we're staying in one of the most stylish homes that I have ever been to. What I mean, I need some crunch and munch. Where's it, sir? What aisle? Where would I find your crunch and munch? And so I'm looking through the store, and the guy, and he didn't think we had any, and I made him actually go in the back into the storeroom and root around in crates in the garage area looking for Crunch and Munch for me because I am a cosmopolitan. And so then the guy says, okay, now look, sir, I'll look for your Crunch and Munch, the rube, but try this caramel corn. And I look down, and some caramel corn from some hippie company in Eugene. I'm like, pish. Search for the toffee-flavored caramel corn now. I demand it. So he's going back looking for more Crunch and Munch. And then he finally he found it. So he eventually discovered like a box of it that was lurking somewhere in the back. He brings it up and I'm like, "Oh, happy day, my Crunch and Munch." And then just as like a favor to him, cuz he'd found the Crunch and Munch, you know, because he'd found like the corporate off an assembly line stamped out of cardboard popcorn form, I then bought like, you know, some of his homemade, you know, like organic, you know, all natural caramel corn just as like a thank you, like a kudo. And it was the best. It was like putting edible gold into my mouth. It was like eating caramel corn shaped sunlight beams. It was unreal. Anyway, I don't even know what my point here was. But on the way there, we drove by this bookstore in Salem, and I looked and it said Tea Party Books, and I said, "My God, that's got to be an because you know you figure that there's no way that a Tea Party bookstore based with you know aligned with the right wing could have come into existence. It was too you know this is too soon for that." And I immediately knew what had happened. It was some hippie bookstore that had probably named themselves after the Boston Tea Party from the Revolution, and that now that has been retconned into something that they don't want to be associated with. And the great thing is, I don't have to root for anybody in this story. Yeah. You know, right-wing nutcases, hippies, doesn't matter. Everybody loses, and that's fine with me.
She says, as you thought, the original name was based on the independent, anti-corporate, more forward-thinking aspects of the Boston Tea Party. But she realized that now the name had to go. And she thought she remembered attending a blessing ceremony in Portland and said, "A Buddhist monk told me in order to move forward, you have to be a tiger. When I was thinking about new names, I thought, oh, that's a good name. Be a tiger." So the Tea Party Bookshop is now Tigress Books. Their new slogan is wildly independent.
Whatever. All right. Except to note this. This is the only other observation I got. Because what do I care? First of all, I don't live in Salem and, you know, there. But for the grace of God and breeding, go I. So I don't. This is not really going to bother me. You know, Tea Party guys, hippies, you know, they all go into the same category, which is the people that I choose not to associate with if you've given the option. Unless they're going to be so unbelievably insane as to become entertaining, which they sometimes do.
Was it Cosmo's caramel corn by some chance?
I don't know. I flushed it out of my head. I'd know the bag if I saw it. Please don't try to locate it for me.
I won't.
And this isn't one of those things where I say, no, please. No, you not forbid. Don't go out of your way.
I wasn't looking it up. I'm just, you know, it came up in the
bag. I could feel my teeth turning into powder as I ate it, too, because it was just so, because sweet things have to have a certain kind of texture and makeup to really appeal to me, because otherwise it's just the sugar is just too much for me. But it was fantastic. The thing about this hippie book stories, though, here's the thing I don't understand about there's any number of things I don't understand about hippies. So they were called the Tea Party Bookstore after the Boston Tea Party, which you would think they wouldn't embrace either because it's a genocidal patriarchy and whatever, right? Because the colonists were Puritans. And by the way, I mean, the original colonists were, I mean, largely religious zealots, it seems to me. And depending on who you ask about this, were religious zealots that were responsible for either, at the very least, an aggressive encroachment on the property that they didn't actually own in any real sense, or a genocidal group of heathens. So it's odd that a hippie bookstore would have embraced that name to begin with.
I believe they may have been simplifying the actual events of the Boston Tea Party. She may have been simplifying it in her own mind when she came up with that name. It's like naming something after Christopher Columbus because, you know, he discovered America.
Right.
Like, well, okay.
I mean, they are hippies.
Should we discuss this? It's like, okay, you're just kind of wrong.
Man, can I just tell you, one of the things that happened to me, speaking of hippies, who were just... I mean, it's just like God scraped the bottom of his shoe, and you know, like he'd run out of clay, and ribs from which to make more humans, and he said, "Well, what's that?" and just molded it into some sort of vaguely human. And I can say this because there, some of my best friends. Well, that's not true, but some of my relatives are hippies. I have had hippies in my home, so I'm allowed to make these observations.
Your wife says it was Cosmos.
Damn you! Damn you!
Capricorn.
Damn you, devil woman! All right. That'll get me some of that today. The thing about hippies, though, is that... never mind. It's just making me tired, even to start thinking about it. When I'm not on the air, when I'm not doing the radio show, and I don't mean like when I go home for the day. I mean like when I've been fired. People think that, you know, I go to the air, that if I just sit around the house stewing around things about things, or if I just, you know, if I have to like call up random strangers in the phone book, call them up and go, "Hello, sir, why do the Howells have so much luggage for a 3-hour trip? Tell me!" You know, and I don't. I go home and I don't really feel the compulsion, you know, if I've been fired or if I'm between radio gigs, I don't really feel this just like impulse to talk all the time or to rant or to monologue most of the time. Occasionally, there will be moments or times when I experience something and it's like, and I know that if I had the radio show, which is sort of like cheap therapy or free therapy, if I had the radio show, I know that I would feel fine about it. But during periods of unemployment, every now and again, something will happen where I just feel like Mr. Hand becomes Mr. Fist. And I just feel like a huge, long, excoriating speech coming on. And Lara has learned to recognize the signs. She'll see, like, the particular, like, my eyes kind of cloud over a little bit, and I sort of, you know, and then my skin gets the slightest shade of green, and she'll sort of steer me away. And one of those things, when I was on Hawthorne, of course, I don't know, like, maybe 2 months ago, and there was some Greenpeace, and I don't mean Greenpeace as a euphemism for hippie, like, actual, like the folks from Greenpeace, who I didn't even think existed anymore. I thought they'd sort of been phased away. I thought they were like the ERA. I thought that somebody had just sort of said, okay, you know, it's now 1982. Goodbye. But so the Greenpeace woman is there, and she's holding a clipboard, and she was like one of the clipboard people that just like wouldn't, like, don't you think, Dawn, that they should respect when you aggressively don't make eye contact?
Yes.
That is a nonverbal way of saying, I don't care about your petition. I don't hate whales. But you know what? What I do hate is stopping on the way to Pete's Coffee right now to talk to you. So please do not speak to me. And so, you know, if you look down, if you look the other way, or if you, as Tim Riley will sometimes do, hurriedly put in fake, like your iPod earbuds or whatever, even if the cord is just like trailing out of, you know, like out of your pocket, just to pretend that you were having a conversation with somebody or listening to something. But she wouldn't, recognize the fact that I didn't want to talk to her. And she stepped in front of me to block my way as I was walking down the sidewalk. And she said, "Sir, can I talk to you a minute about saving endangered species?" And I said, I was just like mustering all the self-control that I could possibly corral in my body. And I said, "Really, if you just want to move to the side so I could, because Pete's and me and the coffee." And she said, "Well, it'll just take a minute. I really want to talk to you about animals that need your protection." And I stopped and I turned to her and I said, "No, I don't care because I am not a Christian." And that confused her for a second. It was like, it's sort of like she did the cow looking at a dictionary thing. And she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, And I said, "What are you?" I said, are you an evangelical? Are you a Jesuit or something?" And she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Do you believe in science or do you believe in creation?" And she said, "Well, I believe in science." And I said, "If you believe in science, you believe in Darwin. If you believe in Darwin, you believe in natural selection. If you believe in natural selection, you should take your clipboard and leave me alone." So that is now the way that I, and by the way, I will pass that advice on to any of you because I know that you all deal with this too. The next time somebody approaches you and they want to, you know, harass you about saving some sort of endangered creature, which might be small and cuddly for all I know, you could just point out the fallacy in the argument to them. Just ask them if they are a religious organization. If they say no, say, then you embrace Darwin. If you embrace Darwin, you should take your clipboard and head on back to your domicile.
The last time I had an issue like that, it was some kind of anti-drug measure, and I wasn't interested in hearing about it. And as I started to try and get past the guy, he said, "Don't you want to stop high school kids from doing drugs?" And all I could think to say was, I can't think of anyone who needs them more.
Yeah, seriously. You know, especially kids, high school kids in small towns, especially. And there's a reason why kids just sit in the basement with a can of Krylon and a paper bag because there's nothing else to do. And you know, and that's just. I'm not saying it's good for you. You probably shouldn't do it, but I understand why you do.
Yeah, better when you're in high school than later when you have to hold down a job.
That's what I'm saying. If you're going to destroy brain cells, kids, do it when you don't have any real responsibilities in your life. Wait until you're very old, or do it when you're very young. Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
I believe we should tackle this epic Michael Jackson watch.
All right, here's your Jackson watch for Thursday right in the Rick Emerson radio program. There is Don Taylor with your Jackson watch for Thursday.
Friday will mark the one-year anniversary of the singer's death from, and there are going to be special exhibits, tributes, and flash mob dances.
I thought it was August when that happened.
It's you would be wrong.
Wow. Okay. So I was always correcting people when they were saying that, well, you know, in last July, no, August. So apparently it didn't make as big a mark on my memory as I thought.
In the family hometown of Gary, Indiana, matriarch Catherine Jackson will unveil a monument to Michael outside the humble house where the legendary Jackson 5 began their career. A memorial and candlelight vigil will follow, ending with the song "We Are the World."
We should have a huge statue of Joe Jackson beating Marlon with a club. You know, like a big, make it really big and gaudy, like a golden statue where he's got like a chair in one hand and like a yardstick in the other, and he's chasing the kids down the street.
The Philippine prisoners who danced their way to fame with their Thriller YouTube video in 2007 will pay homage to the singer by dancing Thriller yet again. What else we got here? Jackson's estranged father, Joe, has helped organize a Forever Michael tribute at a Beverly Hills hotel on June 26, where the 1970s band The Shy Lights and a niece of the Jackson clan are expected to perform.
Boy, that guest list diminished in a hurry.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not even a year ago, I guess, that the whole thing happened. It was that all day, the all day memorial service or whatever it was where, you know, and here's a weird thing. People talk about the Steve Jobs reality distortion field, which is the where you just accept things as true and normal when he says them to you, even though, like in the cold, harsh light of day, you go, well, that doesn't make any sense. Well, of course I need to be able to right-click. What the hell? But so it was with Jackson, because do you remember there was that moment last year at the memorial service where Al Sharpton, who really is just the embodiment of all that is entertaining, he got up there and he said that thing where he was talking presumably to Jackson's kids, who I don't even know if they were there or not, or if they were like...
No, they were there.
Were they actually in physical attendance?
Yeah, because they brought them on stage.
Oh, that's right. See how quickly I've forgotten about it? I've just filed it under things I probably won't need today. There was that moment where Al Sharpton gets up there and Sharpton said, "And there wasn't nothing strange about your daddy."
Yeah.
And we all went, "That's right. It's, speak the word, Al." But then, like a day or so later, we went, hang on a second. And so I think we have now, we've left the Michael Jackson tunnel and are able to sort of go, well, he was amusing and now he's dead.
Some of the more unusual events will take place in Asia, where Jackson had a devoted following. At the world's only official Michael Jackson exhibition, fans selected at random will pay $1,000 for an opportunity to spend the night inside the Neverland collection at Japan's Tokyo Tower, which holds some of his clothes, furniture, and awards from the ranch, which have been on display there since May.
Which would be creepy, by the way. I mean, if you had to spend the night, like, let's say it's just...
surrounded by the dead guy's stuff.
It's not even a dead guy's stuff. It's Michael Jackson and stuff from Neverland. I mean, even if it was like a neutral room, like if it was this room here, and I said, look, I put a little mattress on the floor, you spend the night here in the office, but you're going to be surrounded by figurines from Michael Jackson's bedroom. You wouldn't sleep a wink. You would just sit there staring at the ceiling, your eyes bloodshot and dry.
The cemetery where Jackson is buried near Los Angeles will open its gates to fans on Friday, but they will not be allowed into the mausoleum that contains his body. They have also been curtailed from bringing balloons, doves, radios, or candles.
Were people really, was that a big problem where people were filling their
have
pants full of doves?
Have you seen what happens when anyone famous dies anymore? Do you remember the pictures of like Buckingham Palace?
Yeah.
After Princess died? Just by the side of the road, some kid gets hit by a car, and suddenly there's a pile of balloons and teddy bears.
I was going to say, it's all teddy bears.
I don't know why people do this.
Okay, can I?
I don't understand.
Can I just
am I getting too angry?
No. Okay. No, that's fine. No, I was just talking about shouting at hippies on the street who were just trying to save whales, literally trying to save animals, and I'm yelling at them. This show is all about disproportionate anger.
Okay.
Without my anger, I am, I really am nothing. No, my thing is this. Okay, I'm not even going to say an observation. It's a fact. It is a thing that I was told. So I guess it's maybe, I guess that still counts as firsthand knowledge. It is a fun fact, followed by amusing, followed by a query, a wondering. I know someone who is affiliated with, a bookstore. Put it that way. I will not give any more details. There will be no more explication offered. I know someone who is affiliated with a bookstore, and this person told me...
I love this game, by the way. This is just the best.
This person told me...
I spy with my little eye.
...that, in fact, when a celebrity dies or when an author dies, they do immediately... They have a formula for knowing how many books by or about that person they immediately need to get in stock, how quickly they must be in the store, and how long the surge in interest will last.
That's not surprising.
So, it's not surprising, but that's not surprising only in retrospect. I guess I sort of suspected it, but it did sort of, it was interesting to learn that it actually existed, that they have it, they figured it out, that there's a spreadsheet somewhere. So like, when the Courtney Love finally just begins, when she's not just waxy, but waxy and immobile, that they will find every book that has ever been written about Nirvana or Courtney Love, and they'll know exactly how many to put on the shelf and when they're going to have to remainder them elsewhere to be discounted because people are going to, have stuff. It's like how you saw that, when Jackson died, there was immediately myriad collections of his. And there was a whole theatrical movie that came and went, right? It was This Is It.
Well, yeah, that too. Yeah.
And it was that, but I mean, it came and it was there for like an instant and now it's gone. So that's the factoid.
I'm sorry, something. My shoulder itches and I could only reach it with the pen.
With
so
a ballpoint
while
pen?
While you were talking, I was.
As some sort of a signing bonus for joining the show, would you like me to get you a scratch and stick? Or maybe just a fence that you could...
Poke and stick for my computer, and I could use it as a back scratcher.
So that's the...
And wear my moo-moo like Homer.
So the fun fact, though, is that, yes, is that many bookstores, I'm presuming all bookstores, that they load up on stuff when a celebrity dies. So here's my crass question, though, is that, like... So when there is a 12-year-old, that gets run down by a semi somewhere, do you suppose that immediately the phones are abuzz with people ordering more teddy bears for their toy store or for their,
Well, the Mylar balloons. The party stores suddenly do big business in the Mylar balloons.
But, I mean, is it possible? I mean, I don't even know why I'm whispering. But
the stores actually go, hey, we better stock more teddy bears because...
Let me just ask you this. If you ran a store... Called
Balloons and Bears.
Yeah, I was going to say floaty stuff, so I'm glad you went with balloons, yes. The Balloons and Bears are us. And if that store was next to, a highway, and if that highway was next to an elementary school, and if some morning, God forbid, one of the kids from the elementary school goes into the road, and he gets all gauged, would you immediately check your stock and your storehouse and go, do I have enough balloons and bears to meet the oncoming crush of people?
I think if you were in a small enough town and you were like the primary balloon and bear supplier, if this had happened before, then you would already have experience with it. And yeah, if it happened again, that would be the first thing you thought. It's like, so Yeah. Oh, this kid got hit by a car. Oh, that's sad. Oh, crap. We're going to need more balloons and bears.
And see, and it has. And the first time I remember that happening was here in Portland, and it was for Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis, who were those kids that I remember that guy's name. Is it Ward something or other? But it was that guy that, you know, he kidnapped the girls,
oh, yeah.
and then they were in the backyard underneath his new patio or whatever. But it was just nothing but teddy bears everywhere, to the point that I think the family had to put out a please stop bringing the small animal figures, for the love of God.
I don't understand why they do it with adults. It's creepy enough with children, because it's like, you know, what do you think, that the kid is going to appreciate the teddy bears in heaven? But at least it kind of makes sense because it's a child.
Right.
But I saw one of these once where a policeman had been shot outside a bank, and there was like a big pile of flowers and Mylar balloons, and there were some teddy bears.
He wanted unicorns more than anything.
Yeah. No, he collected Madame Alexander dolls.
You know,
you should bring some of those.
I demand Hummelware at my funeral. You should put it in your... You should actually, like, create your own obituary now and have it on file. You know media people, and just have it, like, you know, in lieu of flowers, she requests Keen paintings to be brought to... to be brought to the nearest 76 gas station and displayed next to the unleaded pump for all to see.
Someone in the... No, I'm not going to read that, Seamus. I'm not going to read that out loud.
Did somebody write something awful?
He wrote something awful.
Okay.
Although someone did say, and this is also awful, but I kind of found it amusing, that when we were talking about the memorials and the teddy bears, he had imagined a child being hit by a car and just exploding into a pile of balloons and bears. And, you know, now every time I see one of those memorials, that's what's going to be in my head.
All right. It's sort of like the reverse of an angel getting its wings, sort of a thing. When I went to see, my final thought on this is when I went to see Dee Dee Ramone's grave, which is at the Forever Hollywood Cemetery. Dee Dee Ramone and Johnny Ramone. Joey's buried in New York, I think, but Dee Dee and Johnny Ramone are at in death as in life, as far away from each other as I think they could possibly get. Dee Dee and Johnny were actually, or Dee Dee and Joey were in. Johnny and Joey were in different ends of the country. Joey's in New York. Dee Dee was in L.A. Because they were just like, I think if he'd known how to kayak, he would have been like off on an ice floe somewhere. Johnny would have, but Dee Dee and Johnny are at the exact opposite ends. Like if you look at it as being a big trapezoid, they are just in corners that are as far apart as you could possibly get. You go to see Johnny Ramone's grave, and it's sort of cool looking. It is a giant statue of whatever those are made of, bronze, I guess, of him in that, you know, he's got the garb, he's got the hair and the
jacket.
I've
seen pictures of that, yeah.
Playing the guitar. He's like on the downstroke with the guitar. And it's like, I would say maybe three times life size. I mean, it's the definition of iconic. You know, but you know, and there's like a note there, like, you know, they love the band, you know, rock or whatever. And then you go to the opposite end of the cemetery. And there's Dee Dee Ramone's grave, and it looks like he was buried in Potter's Field. I mean, it was like he was – it was like one step above like a guy just pounding a wooden cross in outside a tombstone. It's flat. There's like no real – there's a tiny little marker. But it is littered. It is covered with things from fans, of course, which I think tells you the whole story right there. But the two most frequently left items at Dee Dee Ramone's grave are – Chuck Taylor high tops specifically. I mean, there's mounds of Chuck. Sometimes people actually just cut off the little seal, the little crest on the side that says Chuck Taylor All Stars, and they left the little circle, the patch, and inexplicably, high school ID cards.
Really?
I don't know why. There was must have been 75 high school ID cards from people, and a lot of those people, you know, they had graduated within the last 5 or 10 years. So I don't know why that was, if that was something he said or if it was just a tradition that started somehow.
Because of the song Rock and Roll High School?
Or that the Ramones got them through school or whatever. I don't know. It was very weird. Chuck Taylor's in high school ID cards. That's what people leave for that guy.
So my question to you, Mr. Rick Emerson, is have you thought about what you would like to have done at your own memorial service?
Oh.
Do you think about that?
No, I just sort of assumed that I would end it like Walter Winchell, and that there would just be like you know, one guy there because he thought I was somebody else, and so he, you know, he read the newspaper time wrong and showed up to the wrong service, and then the guy named Smitty chewing on a cigar stub waiting to turn the crank and lower me to the ground, and then it would just be, you know, be bereft of people. I don't know.
I had a close friend die in his early 20s, and his memorial service, his funeral was horrible. It was just terrible because his mother was an evangelical Christian, and had just basically got all these church people together and done this big church service that really had very little to do with who he really was. And I've been to a few funerals like that. And of course, funerals are for the people who are surviving. They're not for the dead person. But you go and you're like, wow, this doesn't really reflect who I knew at all. So I decided at that point that I would just sort of keep an ongoing kind of tab where I just make notes. I actually have a file and I have notes to
really
for what I want done.
See, and I have this whole—I guess because I'm very. People have often asked me. You know, people assume sometimes that I am an atheist, and I'm not. I'm more of an—I am an agnostic, I guess. But regardless of the existence or non-existence of God. I figure, you know, when I'm done, my part of the whole thing is over. It's like when you're in acting. You say your last line, you close the book, you can relax. Everybody else, they're going to do the big musical number at the end. Me, I'll be back in the craft services room. So I figure once I'm dead, F it, I don't care. But the other part of that is that I just have this, I have this sort of Spartan sensibility about me in some way. I don't mean like in the, you know, this is, I mean in the, minimalist sense. Mm-hmm. Henry Rollins said this thing one time. He said that the way he wants to die is that he wants to be on his, you know, on his deathbed, literally in his deathbed. And he said he wants to be sort of blogging or writing or, you know, noting in it. He said he wants to have his, I think he said a power book at that time. So this was a few years ago. But he said, I want to be writing, you know, my thoughts and, you know, doing what I do and working until the very end. And he said that this is so awesome. And I wish that Rollins, like with all things that Rollins and George Carlin said, I wish that he hadn't so that I could say it and say it. And Rick Emerson said this great thing. He said that he wanted his last act to be hitting enter and saving whatever he had just written. And then with his last dying breath, he would format the drive. And then he would leave the earth with, like, nothing behind. It would just be, like, the shell of his body, and that's it. Because I can't do that, my whole thing is I have this recurring fantasy, not just for my death, but, like, every day of my life, of just, and I don't mean any disrespect, but just vanishing and just running away from this all of my whole life, just like the Mosquito Coast. There's that sequence in the Mosquito Coast, which is about a family that picks up their life in like Iowa or whatever, and they move to like Venezuela or something, or like the middle of the Amazon or some damn thing. And Harrison Ford is like, America's a dying empire, we got to go. And they literally just run to the airport, they get on a plane, they fly to the Amazon, and they leave everything behind. And his wife is busy doing the dishes in the kitchen. And Harrison Ford's like, we're leaving now. Like, don't bring your clothes. Don't bring anything. We'll take all we need from the jungle. And his wife turns around and she sees the dirty kitchen filled with, you know, garbage and dishes and dirty diapers and all the stuff she has to deal with. And she kind of smiles. And then she just turns and she walks out the front door. And they leave the doors open and, like, the curtains blowing in the window or whatever. And they literally just walk out and they leave the door open and they leave the entire house behind.
That entire movie really was about the fact that Harrison Ford's character was crazy. You know, he was nuts.
Your implication being what?
I'm just saying that.
Anyway, so I have this recurring fantasy of doing that. And I should say, that has nothing to do with the radio show or the whatever. It's just, you and I have talked about this. When Don and I were planning the show, you and I would go to, I'm a creature of habit, so we basically had like three different restaurants that we would cycle between. All of them McMinimins, I think. But I think I told you at one point I was kind of stressing out about a lot of stuff because I had this thing I was putting together, and there was just this other project I was working on, and I had Outlook Portland that day, and there was, you know, all this, there's just billions of things I had to work on. And I told you that I wanted to check myself into rehab because it just seemed like a fantastic get out of life free card. But then you told me that they actually make you do stuff.
And, yeah.
I know most people fantasize about going to Mazatlan, or, you know, I'm going to Tahiti for 3 weeks, or my friend Lacey, who retired from CBS a while back, is moving to Tibet, and she's going to go, I don't know, live in a tree and hit a drum or something, or whatever it is they do in Tibet. My wife did go to the Amazon last year. She took a boat up the Amazon and lived on an island woven together out of reeds in the middle of the river, which is freaky and terrifying and a thing I'll never do. I don't have any of these dreams. My fantasy involves going to, it's like, it could be like a Motel 6, and no one knows I am there. No one knows where to find me. They just, where's Rick? I don't know. He was here. You pay cash. There's no trail. You say, what's your name? Smith. Give me a room. I go in, phone unplugged. Everything went blinds drawn, cell phone, battery out, you know, nothing. And that I'm just there with the blinds drawn in a darkened room where no one can find me or ask me to do anything for like 2 weeks.
I tell you, when I had surgery several years ago, when I took some time off from the most stressful job I have ever had in my life.
Which was?
Editing this community newspaper down in Hooterville. And so, and I got the surgery. And I, for the first time, I finally understood why people develop Munchausen syndrome.
And that's where you are sick to get attention?
Yeah, because when I was recovering from surgery, yes, I was in pain, but all that was expected of me was to lie in bed and take Percocet and sleep and then wake up and like eat a bowl of cereal and watch some TV on DVDs and then take another pain pill and go back to sleep. I didn't have to think about my job. I didn't have to think about paying bills. I didn't have to think about doing the dishes or the laundry or taking care of anything. I just say, honey, can I have a bowl of cereal? You bring it to me. I'd eat it. Honey, can I have some water? I take another pill. Boom, go back out. And it was like that for like, you know, several days.
See, that sounds-
and you're going, I'm getting... no one can make me do anything because they know I had surgery.
See, and that's the thing with like, and I thought with rehab,
it was, other than the pain, it was awesome.
Thing is, well, okay, look if I check into rehab, you know, but then it's like you have to come up with like, well, what, you know, if I was going to fabricate some sort of, you know, stint in rehab, then it's like you have to fabricate, well, what are you in there for? Because it can't be, you know, it can't be like for booze because that's sort of sloppy and sort of that's slovenly. It's kind of a trashy thing. And you're like, well. You know, it can't be like...
You know, the Matthew Perry, like, pill thing. I just became a little too dependent on the back relaxers.
Or where you don't even really define it. You just say, you know, for pain medication or for a prescription meds, you know, because that implies that you see, the thing is, if you check yourself into rehab, I think for prescription meds, it's kind of like the best of both worlds. Like the Munchausen, it's the Munchausen thing, too, because it implies that at some point you were really injured because you got them prescribed to you. But then, you know, you just kind of got hooked.
Yeah, but I think Rush Limbaugh kind of ruined that one for everyone.
Probably. Well, see, but that's the thing is everybody ruins. It's like, what's his name? It was the back-to-back David Duchovny Tiger Woods rehabbing for sex addiction. He's ruined that one. Limbaugh ruined, you know, I had this prescribed for an ailment and then I got hooked on Little Baby Blues and now I'm, you know, so that he ruined that. You know, so it seems like it has to be, you know, and heroin is too dark. Heroin is too, you know, an evil drug. So it has to be cocaine, you know, but then that almost, but people know I work in radio. So if I was hooked on cocaine, then by definition, it means I was probably sticking up old ladies outside of church and stealing their collection money.
And then they think that you were lying all these years about like how much you like, how much caffeine you do.
See, that's the other thing.
You were talking about coke.
Because I have actually spent, because I've spent the vast bulk of my professional career having to disabuse people of the notion that I was wired out of my brain on coke because I just, I think I was just misassembled somewhere along the line. I think so the great architect of the universe put like either one too few or five too many of something into my head, and so I just this is the particular cadence with which I speak. But the thing about going to rehab, though, if I were to just go, no, I am addicted to, and so I'm going to have to be in rehab. Yeah. See, but it's like then you get the added bonus when you come out, you have a certain nobility, like certain manliness, which is strange. I don't think that works for the sex addiction thing. I think it's just for drugs. If you come out of, and even maybe even for booze, if you're a man and you come out of rehab for some sort of chemical addiction. Then it's like you have that sort of proud Sam Elliott kind of thing of, well, you know, I found that one day I wasn't using the coke was using me, and so I had to put an end to that. But see, but then
I beat the monkey on my back.
But then the real danger, though, is that you have used it up, and then if I ever in the future develop a real cocaine problem. Yeah. Then it's like I can't go.
Now you're Robert Downey Jr. and you just, you know, keep falling off the wagon over and over again.
And then you're just a junkie. Yeah. You know, then you're just some dirtbag junkie covered in sores. You know, nobody wants that. So, my low budget fantasy is just to run to a Motel 6 and just stay there for 2 weeks. And everybody says, where's Rick? He was here a second ago. And then I'm just, and that's it, you know? So that's right up there next to the Tom's. And my other fantasy about my funeral, is since you asked that to close this out, is I, of course, like all boys, I have the Tom Sawyer fantasy of showing up at my own wake. And I have thought on more than one occasion during a daydream of faking my own death somehow. But then I thought you can't because it's just such a dick move to do, you know? And that is such a, it is such a thing that DJs do, not with themselves, but idiot DJs are notorious for faking the death or misbroadcasting the death of a celebrity as an April Fool's joke. Where, like, son, you'll always be some jackass radio guy in Tuscaloosa who says, and the mayor's dead, April Fool's. It happens every single year. So, you know, that particular option has been taken away from me. All right. Was that a Jackson watch?
That was a Jackson watch.
God damn.
And that just went horribly far afield from where we started.
Not unlike Jackson himself. There's your... Here's your Jackson Watch. We're going to do another installment of Pop Culture Authority in just a moment. When we come back after that, we will recap Sunday's. Yes, I said from four nights ago, we'll recap Sunday's episode of True Blood. We're trying to get to a religious nutcase watch at some point for the top of the hour as well. This is the Rick Emerson radio program. I'm here alongside Don Taylor. Stay there. Back after this. Don't go anywhere. That's 2 days in a row that Pop Culture Authority thing has screwed me. All right, I'm just going to learn not to. I'm going to learn and not to rely on technology quite so blindly. All right, this is today's installment of Pop Culture Authority.
How did Captain Crunch cereal contribute to the creation of the Apple computer?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Dawn Taylor. Freaking, with a PH, is a term coined to describe a subculture of people who study and hack telecommunication systems. One of the most famous is John Draper, a Vietnam War veteran who, while stationed in Alaska in the late 1960s, helped his fellow servicemen make free phone calls home by creatively accessing the local switchboard. In 1971, Draper discovered that a plastic toy bosun's whistle that came free in boxes of Cap'n Crunch cereal could be modified to emit a tone at precisely 2600 hertz. This resulted in users being able to place free phone calls anywhere in the world. His experiments with the Cap'n Crunch whistle led to Draper's creation of so-called blue boxes, which could emit a number of tones needed to control various trunk lines. A 1971 article about him in Esquire magazine led to Draper being prosecuted for toll fraud and sentenced to 5 years probation. The article also caught the attention of a geeky pair of young entrepreneurs named Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who invited him to work at Apple. Draper created a telephone interface board for the Apple II, but it was never marketed, supposedly because Wozniak was the only guy at Apple who could stand the OCD-afflicted, aggressively counterculture Draper. Crunchman, as he was known in freaking circles, also developed Easy Writer, the first Apple word processor, in 1979, while he was on a work furlough program after a 77 conviction for wire fraud. Cap'n Crunch, Dirty Hippies, Wire Fraud, and Esquire magazine. Just think. Without them, you couldn't demonstrate 78 different varieties of flatulence on your iPhone.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
There, filled up with doubt. I don't know who you think you are, but before tonight is through, I wanna do bad things with you. I wanna do real bad things with you.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program live on the Emerson News Network. This really is a great song.
It is. Unfortunately, the body of his other work doesn't come up to this.
No, it's, I mean, this is one of those make it fast while you can, Jace Everett.
I want to do real bad things with you.
All right, there you go. Which, by the way, he has done to a large degree by, I think somewhere, hold on, I think there's actually a club mix of this song, which doesn't need to exist, so of course it does. Let's see if I've got this here.
I want to do bad things with you.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Welcome to 1998.
God.
This is like back when, like Brooks and Dunn or whoever would do like a hip-hop mix of Boot Scootin' Boogie. And then you'd kill yourself out of shame at the human race. All right. Well, anyway, let's not play that anymore. So there you go. And here's the thing about True Blood is it, not only is that a great song, but the opening credits. I was thinking about this last night, actually, as I finally watched Sunday's episode, which we will get to in just a moment, with more specificity. Very, very, very rarely do I watch opening credits now. We went through this weird time, too, where opening credits didn't exist. They'd gone away.
Yeah.
And then they were brought back by Friends. Friends brought back the opening credits and specifically the opening theme song with that Rembrandt thing. And so now there's a lot of opening credits, but I find that I just don't have the patience. So that's when you realize, you know, because you like to think, well, I'm smarter than the average nitwit American. But then I am just as I have the attention span of a gnat. And that is proven by the fact that, like, when I'm watching even opening credits that I used to enjoy watching, like for Homicide, which are very stylized, flip right by them now. I watch the True Blood opening credits all the way through every time because they're just fantastic. I mean, they're just – is that – do you know if that's new footage they use or is that actual archival footage they use for the opening credits of True Blood?
I think it's a combination.
I mean, it is
– because I've seen that clip with the time lapse of the fox being eaten by the maggots before.
I think
some of that obviously looks like old, like vintage,
like the kid in the Klan robe.
Yeah,
they probably. Although I would find it perversely amusing if one of the grips said, "Like, hold on, I got a kid. Wait, hold on a second. Put this on, Johnny." You talking about that time lapse photography that shows the decomposition of the fox? I know that that predates the show because Trent Reznor used to play that in concert. He would have that behind him as he was singing, you know, whatever. So the credits that I will skip all the time, even though they are brilliant, are the credits for Dexter, because I just find them so deeply unnerving. And there's nothing violent that's happening. If you watch the opening credits for Dexter, I mean, it's just him going about his morning ritual of, like, making breakfast, putting on, you know, shaving, putting on his shoes. But they do this thing with Dexter where all of his mundane activities are filmed and they are filmed and edited as though they are serial killing activities. So, like, he's slicing
into an orange.
Yeah, and he's squeezing it, and he's, like, knotting his – he's tying his shoelaces like he's garroting somebody.
Yeah.
It's very creepy. So True Blood – you warned me. Warned is not the right way to put it. You gave me a little bit of a heads up.
I promised you.
You said there's going to be Nazi werewolves. And I said, you're making that up. And you said, I'm not. And I said, well, okay then. Which I guess makes sense, right? Because we've had Nazi zombies in Dead Snow.
Yeah.
And we've had, you know, we've had every combination of everything. Except I don't think we've had Nazi werewolves, you know, before. The only time was
assuming there has to have been a Nazi werewolf movie.
The only Nazi werewolf movie that I can even think of is She-Wolves of the SS, which is that non-existent Rob Zombie film that was advertised during Grindhouse.
Actually, I'm going to look this up. There was a Nazi werewolf movie that came out just a year or so ago.
Well, but again, that postdates the Rob Zombie thing. So I think that may have been because you know the deal with Grindhouse, they had these fake trailers that they were then going to make into real movies. They were going to make Rob Zombie's She-Wolves of the SS into a movie that was already in pre-production, but then when Grindhouse tanked so badly, they canceled the production of that. So I think somebody might have sprung up to take advantage of that extant marketplace.
Hold on a second. She Wolves of the SS. By the way, as we're looking this up, as I'm looking up Nazis on my computer, which will get me flagged somewhere for something, I would like to thank the commenter in the text box who, on the discussion of funerals, noted that Rick Emerson's funeral will be free, but the reception will be $6.99 to attend. So there you go. Let's see. Do I have the? I don't think I have. I have inexplicably lost.
I'm just. Is Rob Zombie's? Somebody just mentioned this, and I was about to mention it myself. But is the title of Rob Zombie's movie supposed to play in any way off of Ilsa She Wolf of the SS?
Yes. Yeah. Let's see. She Wolf, Nazis, Rob Zombie. It's like I'm just doing one Columbine search after another. All I need to look up is, you know, kerosene. I got nothing. Well, in any event. So I think they put the kibosh on Rob Zombie's Nazi werewolf, and the one that had Nicolas Cage as Fu Manchu. So last night, I'm watching this episode of True Blood, and it was like, as much as you'd prepared me, and as much as, look, this is the third season, and I've watched the first two seasons. So I know that that show is absurd. But here's the thing. As of this season, they know that show is absurd. Yeah. They have fully embraced how utterly ludicrous
The second season, it's like they figure, okay, we're campy, so we'll embrace being campy. Now it's like, oh, we know that they love us for being campy, so we're going to be uber campy.
And I have to tell you, it's a real delicate balancing act, too, because camp is one of those things that's hard to pull off, especially if it's intentional. A lot of times camp is like kitsch, where it only happens retrospectively, and it only happens if the thing is done with sincerity the first time around, i.e. the Shags or pick bad musician of your choice. You know, that's why like irony never works with me, because irony is like intentional camp, which just doesn't work. You know, it's like whimsy is another tone like that. That's why Ally McBeal was great for like two seasons, and then because you can't sustain whimsy very long. It's like trying to keep a balloon in the air just by blowing at it.
Particularly when you become cynical about it and you're being deliberately whimsical as like, you know, a marketing technique.
Exactly. Well, and the campiness as a marketing technique is a thing that gets used all the time now, because people think that is the route to the American wallet. So just to give you a little bit of a if you're one of the last three people on earth that doesn't watch True Blood, I'll give you a little bit of a little overview here of some of the quote acting that happens on that show. So this, I believe, is from last season. This is from season two. And I think this is the character of Bill Compton talking to what's her name, Lorena, which I think that's the vampire that made him. And so this is a flashback, I believe, to when Bill Compton, a vampire with a heart of gold, when he realized he didn't want to be a killer anymore, he wanted to be good and so forth, and he's having the breakup with his girlfriend, who just has him committing all sorts of evil acts. If I can, this is True Blood. This is from season two. This is Bill Compton speaking with them.
You've lost. There we go. You disgust me.
Then let me go.
No, I made you, and you are mine.
You know I don't love you.
You have never tried.
I have spent decades trying. I despise myself for what I did for you. God help me. I killed innocent people to prove to you that I loved you. But it was pure nihilism. I do not. I cannot. I will never love you.
That's awesome. It's the real money thing there is when he goes, it was pure nihilism. And you know this, of course, Don, that everything in my head that is Southern gets filtered through the I don't want your life from Varsity Blues. Let's just hear that last part one more time.
For what I did for you. God help me. I killed innocent people to prove to you that I loved you. But it was pure nihilism.
Oh, that brings me such joy.
It's fantastic. You know what we don't have time for today? You know what we'll do on Monday? There is a point here. Our friend Todd Tulsis, who's been on the show before as a voice actor and as an actor, period, he's going to be on the show Monday. He, I think we can talk about this. He got a part on Leverage, and I think he's already filmed it and everything. But I don't know if you're supposed to say these. I don't know if it's tacky to talk about this. No, I guess not, because Greg does it. And he's a sophisticated young man. But I have done I've done a couple auditions for Leverage. And here's the funny thing about it. It's like they want me It's like they want me to look ridiculous. Well, of course they want me to look ridiculous. So this is, they want something. So when I'm dead someday of the, you know, the cocaine overdose or the whatever it is I'm in rehab for, they can sell these things or put them online or, you know, Rick Emerson behind the scenes. So I have auditioned for Leverage a few times. Every single time, it's been some role that requires an accent. And an accent other than my own, which is the only one I can really do. So there is somewhere on film me doing an accent, not just from the South, but from West Virginia. So I have actually, and you know how it is. You probably audition for things where you have pages of dialogue where I'm having to, it was pure nihilism. And I'm, and my West Virginian voice is Bill Compton.
Well, sure. Why not?
Mean,
of course.
So, I don't know if it's, I don't know. Is it, I hate to, I would ask my, you know, I have a, you know, there's a, I have an agent and whatever. And Lara pointed out for the last 7 months, Lara pointed out that, The entertainment industry in a nutshell can be summed up with the fact that I have two agents and no job. So that really is, that's life in media. I would ask him this, but I'm afraid it would make me look like a rube, not like my southern, like my southern accent. Whether it is inappropriate for me to actually recite the dialogue from the actual audition on the air. Because I don't think those episodes, they've been filmed. I don't know if those episodes have actually aired yet, though.
And once again, the sides that you read when you auditioned may not be anything that actually made it into the show anyway. It could have been substantially rewritten or cut before they actually filmed the show.
I wonder if it's I guess I could have you rewrite the dialogue slightly so I'm not using dialogue from the actual show. But I have had to audition with a West Virginian voice. I've had to audition with a polished British accent, which I cannot do in any way. And I've had to audition with a rough and tumble blue collar British accent, like a bobby, like I was a cop. Here you're going to be stunned by this. I didn't get any of those parts. At no point did they hire me for any of those roles. And yet the thing is, and yet they keep calling me back. They keep asking me back, sometimes more than once. And then no.
I will say though that I keep seeing you in a certain locally aired commercial.
Things from another world, baby.
And it startles me. It just pops up at the oddest times where I'm minding my own business, watching the local news or something. It's like, there's Rick buying something from Aaron Duran.
There's a Things from Another World. They are a proud sponsor of Outlook Portland, which is the television program that I do on the weekends. You can find out more about that at outlookportland.com. It's part of the Emerson News Network, and proudly, Things from Another World is our marquee sponsor. And so we shot a commercial there, and I was there just to, you know, to sort of lend a hand. But there's like, hey, we need an actor. Rick? And I was like, what? And I'm looking behind me because I can't really act. So all I did is I'm holding an Arkham Asylum figurine set. And I think it's just the narration is happening. I don't think you can hear what Aaron and I are saying. If you were able to listen, we're just doing dialogue from Clerks because we're walking cliches. So
yeah, it's there's no actual dialogue. You don't hear you speaking at all. And yet your purchase of this item is still unconvincing.
It's
like you're just standing there holding this thing and Aaron's talking to you. You've just got your arms outstretched and you're holding this at him.
I can't even do sincere standing in place. I actually have a vocal coach that I work with because I do, you know, I do some voiceover work and whatever. Maybe she'll help me speak like somebody other than Bill Compton. But she actually asked me at one point, she said, so you've done radio, you've done commercial work, you've done a little bit. Have you done stage work? And I said, well, I'm still not bigger than Jesus and whatever. And she said, okay, so what are your weaknesses as a vocal performer? And I said, being sincere or believable in any way. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, okay, I'll show you. Give me some copy. And a copy is like a script. So she hands me copy for it's just like dummy copy. She hands me like a script for a car lot. And she said, just read that like you normally would. And I said, you know, come on down and save, save, save. And she goes, okay, stop. I understand the problem. Okay. So she immediately, I just can't sound sincere. But for Leverage, they call me in and they're like, okay, so is your Southern accent already? And it's like, we should talk about this another day. We should talk about this Monday. So, but I will just say that
we'll discuss this Monday.
My Southern accent, though, is this.
Proved to you that I loved you. But it was pure nihilism.
That's me. So there you go. So that's some acting from True Blood. So I'm watching last night, and I'm just going to go through these sound bites one at a time here, and you know, we'll just sort of, I'll just play them as they lay, as the saying goes. I don't know what I expected, but what I got was just, it was like equal parts gay porn, Harlequin porn, And, you know, and like something that would be showing in Times Square in like 1988, you know, right between I Eat Your Skin and Sorority Babes at the Slimeball Bolarama, as part of a Troma triple feature. This first sequence is, this is, I believe, this is the loathsome character of Tara. Boy, do you just wish that they would kill her and her whole family off?
I don't know if you're going to address this, but yeah, in the recent episode, she started swallowing down pills because she's so unhappy that Eggs is gone.
Eggs is her and, boyfriend.
And I was so happy to see Eggs get killed. I mean, now I'm just, I was rooting for Tara to succeed.
Well, her, that mother of hers, and I, and it's,
the mother.
And I understand that, you know, that the character is supposed to be unlikable, but there comes a point where even an unlikable character is too unlikable.
Yeah.
See also Michelle Rodriguez in anything, but specifically in Lost. She's the reason I quit watching Lost. And I never went back. So this is this gives you a little bit of insight into how this show operates, the universe in which this show takes place. This is Tara talking to her cousin Lafayette about last season's events.
The one time in my entire life I thought I was happy. I was a zombie.
It's a zombie.
What the hell is wrong with me, Lafayette?
I wish I could really act.
Life ain't not having problems, Tara.
Life ain't not having problems.
Hey, Lafayette has a point.
Oh, sorry.
It's about being able to deal with the ones you got.
Well, obviously I can't.
You can.
All right.
No,
so
she really can't.
That, and Lafayette can grate on me a little bit too because the character's just played so broad, but I can get with that because I think he is meant to be a very exaggerated. I mean, he is a self, in other words, the character is he is consciously exaggerating his own mannerisms.
I liked the direction they were taking his character, where he got captured by the vampires and brutalized, violated, you know, by the vampires, and now he's got like this whole PTSD vampire thing going on.
Yeah,
and I'm hoping that actually goes somewhere, that he's not just a cringing coward. That's all we have to offer from this.
He's turned into the sage dispenser of country wisdom. That's kind of what he's become at
Life
this point.
Life ain't
of the show.
About not having problems, Rick.
Who can argue with that?
Yes.
Okay, this is, I believe this is the sequence.
It's totally.
Yeah, this is the sequence where, so Sookie is standing in her kitchen.
Sookie!
See, you're telegraphing, but it's so awesome. We have made fun forever of the fact that when Bill Compton, when he says her name, Sookie, which is just an awkward name to begin with, that it just comes out to Sookie.
Sookie!
And in that the greatest moment that True Blood has ever had is the first season episode where he's coming to her rescue even as he's marching through a cemetery. And, of course, he's a vampire and the sun is out. And it's like noon, so he's on fire. And he's literally on fire trudging through a cemetery. And by the I know it's supposed to be tragic, but by the time he gets to her, all of the skin has burned off his body. He has no lips of any kind. And so and I know it's supposed to be touching, but Sookie leans down over his like smoking body, which again is fundamentally just a skull. I mean, at that point, and like through his skull teeth, he just says, "Thucky." "Thucky" is what comes out. But his pronunciation of her name is a sort of ongoing hilarity. So this is Sookie actually speaking to her brother Jason, and this is the moment last night when I realized, okay, they know that we're onto them. They know that we know what they're doing. So this is a...
Well, what can I do to help?
Because Bill's gone.
Apparently that's what I'm supposed to do too, which is totally impossible. Every sound I hear, every time the phone rings, every shadow in the corner of my eye, I think it's Bill. I keep expecting him to come through the door and say, "Sookie."
Somebody in the chat box is like, "Oh, spoilers! Like it was on Sunday."
And really, if
come on,
let's be honest here. It's not like I'm giving away the page 744 of Deathly Hallows or something. let's have a sense of proportion, shall we? All right. Let's see. I don't even know what this one. This is a sequence where Sookie is talking to Eric, who is the most interesting character on the show, by the way.
Yeah.
I would watch the Eric show. Like if he's a vampire, he was a Nazi, now he's living next door. He's Eric. Hey, he's Eric Nighthorse or whatever the hell his name. What is his name?
Dark Knight.
What is his name? His last name is it's some D&D name.
Yeah.
He has some like Warhammer 40,000 style.
You know that actor is Stellan Skarsgård's son.
No.
Right?
Really?
Yeah. Alexander Skarsgård. He's Stellan Skarsgård's
I guess I should have made that connection with the last name. All right. He's the best character. If they gave him a kooky spinoff of his own, where you know
Fangoria, the show.
He'll borrow some sugar and he'll drink your blood. He's Eric's blah 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 dark stride horse, whatever his name is.
Eric Darkstride.
Doesn't that sound like it should be his name? I'm Eric Darkstride. Let me in. So this is
Eric Northman.
Whatever. He's Northman. Sorry. So she's talking to. But see, that's like it's like another Lord of the Rings style name. She's talking to Eric, and this is after they have had a flashback sequence about how he was in fact a Nazi werewolf, and the escalating levels of absurdity in this dialogue. All right. So here, this is Sookie speaking to Eric.
You and Godric were in the SS?
We posed as whatever would help us in our search.
But you were hunting the Nazi werewolves.
The symbol is runic. This pack dates back a lot farther than the Nazi party.
So they aren't Nazis?
No, they're much more than that. These are not ordinary werewolves.
They're not ordinary werewolves, and they're not ordinary Nazis.
No.
And furthermore, they're
more than Nazis.
And they're not ordinary werewolf Nazis either. They're a whole fourth thing.
Right.
Jesus.
They're organized, well-funded, highly trained.
They're well-funded werewolves. What exactly... Where does the funding requirement come in? Is there some sort of a budgetary overhead that they put together? Do they have PowerPoint presentations for new recruits that need to be animated in Flash or something?
They have to pay dues.
And fueled by vampire blood.
They are, let me understand this, they are something well-organized.
They're well-organized, well-funded Nazi werewolves.
They're organized, well-funded, highly trained, and fueled by vampire blood.
Well, that really is something to worry about, because normally a werewolf you could just brush off as a non-threat.
Why didn't you tell me last night?
Last night.
The question is, why am I risking everything to tell you now?
Which is where it begins this absurd descent into porn dialogue, which continues here. It's like one, it really is just one step away from like, well, my hot water heater's out. Do you mind if I shower here with your sister?
Numerous places you were never found.
But.
He's looking pensive, by the way, this whole time because he's tormented.
Now, is this a scene where he's naked?
They're all, aren't they? Oh, no, they're sitting in the porch.
She came to see him, and he was in the middle of doing something.
He's in the middle of a hump session.
And he just walked over to her naked?
No, that's where he is humping. They've done this device several times, actually. There's a woman chained, manacled at her wrist, and she's, like, hanging from wrist manacles, nude, and a guy's just giving her the high hard one, like at jackhammer speeds. That's she walks in and he's over there giving this woman like a pneumatic ovary punch, and Sookie's like, well, I'll just wait till you're done, I guess. He finishes and, yes, can I help you? Look at my penis. And he's just standing there. No, they're on the front porch,
okay.
And he is he's conflicted because he doesn't. There was this like ham-handed sequence earlier where it's like it was like this bad Jedi thing of like a true vampire masters his emotions. He is not mastered by them, and here he's clearly though in love with Sookie. Fucky.
But
now they're coming for you, and I owe you.
I have all these ellipses on the pages.
When you said you were risking everything to tell me, what did that mean?
The goal tonight was to keep you out of danger, not put you in more of it.
You can't just say something like that and leave.
Well, I'm not leaving.
Okay, wait for it. Here's where we really just here's where you ramp up right into housewife territory.
How about both?
You're not gonna do.
So I can protect you.
Eric, you can't just say something like that. And leave.
Well, I'm not leaving. You're going to invite me in, so I can protect you, or have passionate primal sex with you. How about both?
You're not going to distract me while talking nasty.
I already have.
I mean, it's like you can just hear the hum of D-cell batteries springing to life all over Beaverton. No pun intended. As that dialogue is playing. At what point... Do you agree with me that Bill has become... Bill is the Luke, and Eric is the Han. You know, they must have determined at some point that Bill was no longer sexy enough for women, because then they introduced, Eric, who clearly is meant to be... like the sexy one.
Yeah. It's like when they brought in Riley on Buffy.
Yes.
And he was just this huge load, and you kept going, oh, she should have sex with Spike. Even though Spike is really annoying and he's stalking her, she should just have sex with Spike. And eventually they went, you know, you're right, audience. She should have sex with Spike. Let's just kill Riley.
Oh, God. If only they could have killed him before that horrible sequence where they were sexing and it created a big plant that enveloped the entire frat house. God damn. Every time I saw Riley on Buffy, I just expect he looked like that guy from Soap Dish. I expected him to go, I was at the gym doing leg lifts when I heard...
Every time I see Mark Lucas on anything, it's just immediately, it's like, oh, it's Riley the Load. And
Riley the Load.
Opening today in theaters, the movie Night and Day, which is actually really very, very entertaining, Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. But there's a scene, and you see it in the trailer, in the ad, where Mark Lucas plays this guy that knows Cameron Diaz, and Tom Cruise shoots him in the leg. And as we're going to see the movie, I'm like, I have such high hopes for this movie. James Mangold directed, it should be good. And my husband says, well, any movie where they shoot Riley in the leg, that's going to be a bonus.
Yeah, I know. I'm all for that.
Like, for the whole rest of his career, he's going to be like, it's Riley.
Oh, yeah, you're that guy I associate with one of the worst ever seasons of Buffy. Well done. All right. Well, on that note, we will not have time to get to the religious nutcase watch today. That will have to happen tomorrow. And we didn't get to the tasing a watermelon thing, but that's just as well, because I want to make sure that Sarah's got the stun gun.
And we still haven't done that top five.
I was going to pretend that hadn't been put on the docket to begin with.
So, but we have so much richness and beauty
and
to
texture.
Bring to the people later.
Yes, and tomorrow, Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler will join us on the program sometime in the 1 o'clock hour, and we'll talk about the Fun Employment Radio Listener Party, which is coming up the day after tomorrow. That is coming up Saturday, the 26th. The Hawthorne Theater. So, Fun Employment Radio later on today at funemploymentradio.com. Don't forget, you can hear the show archived anytime, day or night. It is at rickemerson.com. You can also hear us from noon to one every weekday at legionofnews.com or pdx.fm. So as always, this is Rick Emerson saying today's program is made possible by a generous grant from you, the best audience ever. So thank you so much. I appreciate it. And without y'all, there would be no us. So we thank you for being out there. Please spread the word. We will see you all tomorrow. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Dawn Taylor at the news desk. Our chief of staff today is Cheryl Kanakoa. And we will see you all tomorrow for Friday. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being out there. It is Thursday, June 24th, 2010. And that is The Frequency, Kenneth. See you all tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening. Attention.